The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, if I told you the United States had the capacity to knock out the Soviet Union 100 times over, and they had the capacity to knock out the United States 100 times over, and between us both, we could kill the world about 20 or 30 or 50 times, they argue about that. And then I told you that we're in the midst of one of the most gigantic arms races the world has ever seen, that more and more nations are joining the nuclear club, that proliferation of nuclear weapons, in spite of SALT talks and nuclear non-proliferation treaties, are growing apace. I imagine you would wonder why. The last couple of programs I have mentioned that fully half of the brain power of science is engaged in military research of development of weapons and of ever more sophisticated methods of killing one another. And as I've said so many times, if I were to tell you that fully 50% of the scientific brain power of the world were devoted to finding a cause and cure of cancer, you would expect dramatic results. You'd say, now we're really getting on to it. We got something going. Well, let me tell you, when I can say that fully half, that is a half a million scientists and engineers, are engaged in the development, the sophistication of existing military weaponry, or of investigating newer and more effective methods of killing one another, whether we're talking of biological or toxic, poisonous warfare or nuclear weapons or conventional weapons, you can also expect equally dramatic results. Does it make any sense, this ancient, tired, shop-worn guns versus butter issue of nation after nation, the minute the revolution is over, the new king, the new emperor, the new dictator, the new governor of some kind is ensconced in the seat of power, then what's the very first thing he does? Does he usually set about fulfilling all the tremendous promises he made to the people who helped plummet him to a position of towering authority? No, the usual thing he does, if you witness all of the military dictatorships that have emerged in Central and South America over the past many decades, those of Africa, the one emerging even now inside Portugal, the very first thing he does is to consolidate his own position. So first you hear the monotonous crackle of rifle fire as the purge begins and all political enemies are erased. People are herded to the public arena and lined up against the wall and machine gunned into blood-spattered bits. And then he goes about hiring all the people closest to him, maybe even cousins, uncles, and brothers, and maybe he'd better be careful about that if you look at what happened down in Saudi Arabia not so long ago. Because sometimes even a close relative in this nepotism business can be dangerous to have near the throne. And then very quickly he goes shopping for modern arms. On my most recent trip to France, when I stopped at the Dassault factory at Bordeaux, I'd never seen a Mirage 1 with a great big green ball on it, just a green blob of paint, and I wondered, what in the world is that? And here were a whole line of other aircraft parked there with this same type of insignia. And then I read in a flying magazine about a purchase of a whole series of Cessna twin-engine 310s by the same nation, Zaire. It's amazing to see the nations coming shopping to Europe, to the arms manufacturers of Belgium, of France, of West Germany, Britain, the United States, and even the Soviet Union, for modern, sophisticated weapons. The first thing they want to do is to spend money to, quote, defend themselves, end quote. And then, of course, when their weapons become a little greater in number, a little more sophisticated in development, then the neighboring countries get a little nervous and they decide they've got to step up their arms spending in order to achieve a kind of a stalemate. And so back and forth goes the teeter-totter of unbelievable billions upon billions of expenditures until finally it appears we're trying to get to the point where every nation on the face of the earth would have the total nuclear capacity to obliterate every other nation on the face of the earth, and finally we will have peace. The Soviet Union and the United States can obliterate each other 100 times over, but that's not enough. We want 101, don't we? 110, 169, 171. When will we be happy? When we can obliterate each other 240,967.3 times. When once would be exactly enough. Once would be enough. And yet the expenditures go on. Now, as I was saying, and perhaps it's a little mind-boggling, but it's true nevertheless. You're facing an unbelievable impasse when, on the one hand, we are hooked like a heroin addict to a monstrous worldwide arms race involving half of the scientific brains of the world and tremendous hundreds of billions of dollars. We're hooked because our economies are hooked, because aerospace, military research, and as I pointed out so many times, practically everything you see and use, clothing you wear, your watch band, your pencil, your glasses, things you look through, things you eat, the pills you ingest, the pantyhose your wife wears, practically everything you use in building materials, transportation, automobiles, aircraft, communications, miniaturization, everything we've got around us is the direct spinoff of military research and development, a result of man's ingenuity at warfare. So our whole new era of lightweight building materials and of miniaturization of communications facilities and so on is a direct spinoff from the military. So you see, in the one sense, it's an impasse, because if we got off this heroin-like binge of being hooked on military spending, we would go to war because of the collapse of the economy of one country after another. That's why I say, though it sounds weird, if peace were to break out tomorrow, war would be the result. Now that's kind of like saying it's the irresistible force and the immovable object. You're hanged if you do and hanged if you don't, and that's quite right. That's exactly where we are in world conditions. And as long as you look for a human-made, a man-made, man-devised solution, you are going to be denied the answer and the solution as to where we stand in this world and where we're going to be in the next 3, 5, 10, whatever number of years. If you just someday could go to a museum, I wish somebody would put up a museum, or better yet, a modern exposition hall, where they would give you the true overview of the present-day world conditions, like a president of the world giving you a state of the world address. And you could walk into this hall, and we would have it all categorized to where you could look at the human element of the illiteracy, the starvation, the squalor, the poverty, the fact that about 8 out of 10 of the people in the world don't wear shoes, that a tremendous percentage of them are illiterate, that a vast number of literally dozens of millions face imminent starvation. We would deal with the human element first. We would see all these peoples of Asia, of the periphery of Southeast Asia, India and Bangladesh. If you saw one of the recent editions of National Geographic, you saw one of the most sickening exposés or articles on Bangladesh and the condition of famine there. And we would study the human element, and we would ask these questions. Is man becoming more educated? Is he becoming more cultured? Is he really advancing? Is he enjoying the good life? Is country after country moving toward the basic essentials of life, of simply food and clothing and housing for its people? The answer would be a huge red letter no. It's going in the opposite direction. We would look at agronomy and agriculture. We'd look at the entirety of the Green Revolution in retrospect, in hindsight. We would talk about the number of arable acres there are. There would be big maps there, all colored the way some of them are now as a result of some of the satellite photography that you can see. And you would be told, when most of the world, the earth, is water, and a tremendous amount of it is desert. It's too steep. It's too high. It's too low. It's too dry. It's too wet. There are reasons why most of the earth cannot be arable and cannot be cultivated. And you would put this in your mind. It's an added factor as you're walking through this huge exposition hall of the way the world really is today. Then maybe you would come to the question of disease and of personal health. And he would ask whether or not we are really stamping out disease, or whether we have seen in the past 3 or 4 decades a virtual stamping out of the ancient old diseases that used to afflict people back in World War I and before. Typhus, diphtheria, scarlet fever, yellow fever, some of those that are usually found in Asia but largely in the developed countries are almost unknown, bubonic plague, etc. But instead you would see we have replaced those diseases, which we brought under control by massive health programs, by education, by inoculation, by different diet. And you would see that today we've got modern man-made diseases, virtually man-made. Man-made in the sense of the tremendous stress we place on ourselves in this modern society of ours. Man-made in the sense of our soft, prepared, packaged, preserved, artificially colored, artificially ingested with all kinds of nutrients, we think, at least chemically. And we see that, I mean, they've got milk that will not spoil for a year. You got formaldehyde in it. You can buy milk and it's just guaranteed. They got a new milk on the market now that says guaranteed never to spoil. Give me some of that. I want to put it in my radiator. You know, what in the world? But anyway, we've got foods like this that when you put it in you, your body can't even spoil it. I mean, nothing's going to happen to it and you're digesting. When it comes out, it's going to still be the same way it was when you put it in there, presumably. So, from so many points of view, whether you're talking about physical health, lack of exercise, all of our prepared foods, the stresses on us today, we have replaced all these old diseases with the modern diseases. And what is that statistic? It's something like 3 out of 4 American men are destined to die of cardiovascular-related diseases. They're not going to die in bed at old age, having worked themselves to death. They're not going to die like the guy says he wants to be killed at age 99 by a jealous husband. They're not going to die any of the classic deaths. They're going to topple over at age 34, 42, and 56 of a heart attack. The statistics on heart attacks are incredible. I think of 55,000 Americans dead every single year on the highway as a result of accidents. And that was a figure towering above, you know, just barely equivalent in any one given year to the total war dead of Vietnam, which went way ahead of the Korean War dead. But now stop to think that 55,000 is what percent of a million? Well, about a million Americans die every single year of heart attacks. So you'd have to put this overview over here in one of the walls. You're going along, you're looking, you're asking, you're wondering about the state of humankind. And you'd have to look at the economies of the world. And you would look at utter chaos. You'd have a big map and it would show you maybe some bar graphs and statistics of balance of payments deficits, of devaluation of currency, of the pouring. There'd have to be a big illustration there of just the pouring of gold, of bullion, silver, of dollars, of all of the European currencies into the coffers of the oil-rich Arabs. And you would see a complete displacement in about a year and a half of the bulk of the world's wealth. Then you'd have to have a huge, big area to show you what's going on in all the stocks. The huge stock. Here's one of the greatest railroads in U.S. history, down the drain, totally bankrupt. Here's the ancient, old, wonderful, pioneering aircraft company, the Pan American Airlines, that used to fly the old Sikorsky Flying Clippers across the pioneer routes of the North Atlantic. And where that airline went, the American flag went with it, Pan American. Many of the major corporations in the United States, including General Motors and the blue chip stock companies, are being bought into very, very heavily to the tune of hundreds of millions by oil-rich Arabs. They are buying land, hundreds of thousands of acres. They're buying mining properties. They're buying investment properties. They're buying into businesses and into manufacturing and development concerns, into real estate and land development projects. The Japanese are buying into our timber tracts. And, you know, you begin to look around and pretty soon the American people are going to see, keep out, Japanese property. Turn around, drive down, look at the next national park, keep out. This belongs to the Sheikh of Abu Dhabi. And then somebody else is going to say, get out, keep your camels off my desert. Arizona was just bought by Khashoggi. You know who Khashoggi is, don't you? He's a very, very wealthy Arab who was going to buy that bank out in California, and then some kind of chicanery came along with one of the major oil companies being willing to admit, and I don't know whether you can really blame the oil company in our self-righteous fit of name-calling in the United States for doing what apparently they're forced to do, but it has now been revealed that many major companies have had to give under-the-table payoffs and kickbacks to leading Arab officials and to generals and military people in order to do business in these countries. And this guy's name was suddenly there. So you'd have to have this one exposition that would show all the conditions of our present economy and just how shot through with foreign investments it is, and what might occur in the event of a new war in the Middle East, a new energy embargo, And then, any retaliatory thing, which we did, you know, to Castro's Cuba, which we did to Japan during World War II, which is the freezing of assets of these companies in U.S. banks. So the extent to which they invest is the extent to which they are taking a risk, just like we have always taken a risk in Peru or Bolivia or Chile or Argentina. When we go down there and we invest up to the tune of maybe 44% in one nation or maybe 49% in another, and it has to be 51% their national ownership, we can lose it all. They nationalize it. That's a polite word for steal. And when the revolution is accomplished, then the leader says, we're going to grab it all. So your tools, your equipment, your trucks, your buildings, everything you've got down there, with the conceivable exception of your top management echelon, if they can escape with their lives and avoid being kidnapped by a terrorist organization, and they're taken out of the country, and it's all left to the people of the original country, the investment there, and they simply call it their own. Now, if we were to do that in the United States, it'd be the bad news all the way around. Nobody would want to stand for that. It was only mildly hinted to the Egyptian government that since they are recipient of American aid and food shipments, that maybe the United States would think about maybe cutting off some of that food if they're going to cut off their flow of oil. And so then it was the Algerian foreign minister who stood up in the OPEC conference down there in Algiers about a year ago and said it is inadmissible that any modern nation should conceive of using the means of survival as a political weapon. And I thought, what kind of a statement like that when he is the oil minister of one of the leading Arab nations who voted to cut off the flow of oil to Europe, to Japan, to the United States, and to everybody else as a political move, and yet he says you can't use any really essential means for survival as a political weapon. But you know, when you think of oil, you tend to think of fuel for automobiles and trucks and buses and aircraft. And that's just the beginning of the story. Do you realize that most all the fertilizers in the world are petroleum-based? Do you realize that your entire plastics and petrochemical industry in the United States that actually involves a quarter of the labor force is engaged in manufacturing products that basically are petroleum-based? Do you realize that even your vitamin pills that you are swallowing from time to time are made out of petroleum products? You realize that not only fertilizer, but the pesticides, the herbicides, and the others are also of an oil base in order to stick on the leafy vegetables and the roots and so on. And so when you see a nation like India with a desperate problem of feeding the millions of people and they're cut off with the oil, that is a huge economic problem as well. So as you went from one room to another in this big exposition hall, looking at the state of the world, you would get increasingly depressed. And you would come to the conclusion after you'd been through about the third room, where you're just looking at one portion of the problem after another, that there are no solutions. You look at education. You wouldn't want to, but you'd look at it. And you would see the most unbelievable spectacle of armed policemen in schools. You would see that now kids clear down the eighth grade and below are carrying guns and knives commonly to school. You would see that every school, including even grade schools, has its known drug pushers. You would see that into the classrooms of the United States are coming hard drugs, bennies, yellows, reds, the whole business. The kids are, quote, horning it, you know, way down in the junior high and below, that we're finding now drug addicts even before they get to teenage, 11, 12 years of age and before, and you would see an unprecedented violence beginning to emerge in the schools of the United States more than ever before, and how instead now, as has been said recently by those involved in the national level of education, of American campuses being the battleground between rioting students and police, now it has moved into the classroom of the high schools and below, clear down into junior high and elementary. You would see there isn't enough money to educate them. You would see that we're spending a fraction to educate our children on what we're spending on preparation for war, for nuclear overkill beyond what we've already got. You would begin to see the disproportion, the disparity between these expenditures. You would see a complete irrationale of priorities in what nations are spending their money for. The guns versus butter issue again. And after you got good and sick to your stomach about the quality of facilities the crowded classrooms, the low pay, sometimes the incredible ineptitude of some teachers as opposed to the tremendous professionalism of many others, and the majority, I might add, but also the fact that many teachers are saying, look, I can't teach school anymore when 90% of my energy and my time is taken up with just trying to keep some kind of decent order to the point I can be heard. There's no point in me trying to give a lesson to some of these kids. They won't listen. And you know, you listen to what the teachers say and you read any articles about the classroom situation today. If you're a parent, you've got a kid in school, why don't you wise up? Why don't you go visit the school someday? Take a bodyguard, wear an armor-plated vest, but visit the school. Make sure somebody's along with you in uniform and a gun in his hip, but go ahead, visit the school. Do yourself a favor and find out about education. You'll get a shock. It's a lot worse than you like to think it is. Now, from education, you could go into the science hall and you could wonder what science is doing. Well, I've already covered that. They're spending most of their time and money on military research. You could wonder whether we're closer to conquering the common cold or cancer. But you could look at medicine and the state of American health, at least. And the fact is about 92 million Americans have a chronic disease or another. The fact of early death for our men who's dying, toppling over in middle age. You could look at the next level, perhaps, of the exposition, which would show you the child mortality rate, the number of children who are born handicapped. You would look at the picture of illegitimacy, of abortion, of the unbelievable number of babies born minus their limb or their full senses, born with diseases, born already hooked on drugs. And that would be a very gloomy and a very sad picture. And by the time you'd gone all the way through this exposition hall, looked at the whole of the world, looked at world weather, at the drought cycle that is right now upon us, at nuclear arms and many, many times overkill, at the fact that the wars of the world are still being heated up, and the potential for explosions in Korea, the Middle East, other places in the world are always with us, you would come out of that exposition hall of a real brief overview of the entirety of the human race as we stand right now, looking on in to the next century. You'd look at the population curves, of the fact that we're supposed to double the world's population by about the turn of 2000, and double again in another 35 years, and then double again in about another 17 years. And you would come away from any such exposition hall absolutely convinced that this world has had it, and that there are no solutions. The food versus population curve all by itself would convince you of that. You wouldn't have to have an exposition hall. You could just write for the current number of the Plain Truth. If you want a publication that gives you the overview, you could look at such organizations as the Club of Rome and its publication of these non-paid, non-politically aligned scientists from about 100 separate countries who have gathered together and given their expertise into one effort to merely try to take the temperature of the tired old world the way we really are and to ask and to answer the question, where do we go from here? It's just that simple. They want to know about the food versus population curve and where it crosses. And when you look at those statistics, it's already crossed. I mean, we had a tremendous crop last year. Now, we had a drought, but we still had a crop that was bigger because a tremendous number of additional acreage was put into production. But the yield per acre was down, and the actual crop on a percentage basis was down, but the raw figures of the number of bushels went up. And yet, in the United States, we just barely stayed even. That didn't mean putting anything back into reserves. And you know, we need another Joseph to show up. If we'd have had any sense, we'd have put a lot of our money into huge grain storage bins a long time ago. I'll tell you, nation after nation should have thought of that, just like Joseph in Egypt. They should have thought of getting ready for years and years of real hard going with regard to food. And I know that a lot of people in the United States are looking with jaundiced eye toward the possibility of the breakdown in our fragile cities and our transportation systems and our farm products getting to the marketplace, not only in soaring prices, but in literally drought or natural disaster that can interrupt very quickly the normal flow of our society to the point that the food just isn't in the supermarket anymore. A lot of people have wanted to lay up about a 3 month or a 6 month or even a full year's supply in freezers and dried foods. And there are people that are engaged in businesses now. And I heard one interviewed on television recently that seemed to make a lot of sense because he was talking about dried. And this would be the type of thing that wouldn't require electricity, you see, wouldn't require energy sources to simply store. And he was talking about dried foods and that it just made good common sense in the troubled times in which we live, where practically anything can interrupt with food supplies for people to have something on hand for an emergency. I'll tell you, you look at this impasse and you wonder, what in the world is the solution? Where are there solutions for these problems? And if you're going to look to a human source, I say again and again, there just are no solutions. Doesn't mean there aren't any solutions, because there are. But those solutions, people simply don't want to look at. I don't know why. It's the best news they could possibly hear. It was brought to the earth nearly 2,000 years ago by Jesus Christ of Nazareth. It's called the gospel. But people, when they hear the name gospel, they think that means get religion. Jump up and down, clap your hands and say hallelujah, praise the Lord. They don't know what in the world that's got to do with planting corn or storing grain or solving the problems of human health or illiteracy or disease. They don't know what in the world the gospel might have to do with the weather or the nuclear arms race or a coming Armageddon World War III with nuclear weapons. But if they had read the Gospels, if they knew that the four Gospels, including the Olivet prophecy of Jesus Christ, zero in on the time when the potential for human destruction would be a very reality with which we live, they would know a little more. They would have the overview. They would know there is a God, that God does exist. He is a literal being in a specific place, that His Son, Jesus Christ, did rise from the dead, that He is at His right hand, that He is on a countdown from heaven, that He is literally going to come back to the earth and rule it with a rod of iron. Can you believe people who feel they are, quote, Christian, end quote? That is, they're professing Christian. They say, praise the Lord, I'm saved. And yet they've never read the only two scriptures in the entirety of the New Testament that promise them what they're supposed to inherit. They don't know what a Christian is supposed to get. Now, I'm not talking about going to heaven. I'm saying, where are the two scriptures in the entirety of the Bible to tell you if you overcome? You know, you're to live a life of overcoming if you're a Christian. It says that very plainly over and over and over again. You're to give your life to God. You're to have the transformation of your mind, the renewing of your mind, as it says in Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. To be a new and a different personality, a new, different kind of a man. And it says you are to overcome. To him that overcomes will I grant, Jesus said, and then made a promise. And he said, will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne, in Revelation 3:21 and Revelation 2:26. He also says, to him that overcometh will I give power over the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. I don't think you'll see most professing Christians actually believing that he is going to have the power and the ability to rule over nations on in the next century sometime and to straighten out the problems that exist. But that is nevertheless the promise of the Gospels. Well, I've got to break off again for lack of time. I'll continue on the same subject next time. In the meantime, why don't you write for your free copy of The Plain Truth? And while you're at it, request the booklet, What is the True Gospel? And the booklet, Just What Do You Mean? The Kingdom of God. We'll get it in the mail to you as quickly as we receive your letter. There's never any bill to follow. If you would like to know the call letters of the station to which you're listening, the name of this radio station, and then we'll get your Plain Truth in the mail as quickly as we can.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO Sydney, New South Wales. Thank you.